You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Michael Warren Thomas. Michael, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate the time.
So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Just to kind of get at, what do we need to know? Who are you? What do we need to know about your life, about your values, about what you aspire, who you aspire to be, to start this conversation?
This is a five-hour interview, you said, or?
Well, you know, we've actually had re-interviews over the years, but.
Well, I guess in some ways I am what I do radio shows about, which is savor life, appreciating life through gardening, through food, through, which means growing some food and cooking, appreciating the chefs and the restaurants of our region, and the wines and the beverages, they just the bounty of this area that we live in. I think people might be surprised that this is actually what I do. I mean, I choose to talk about it on the radio, but you know, after this interview, I'm going to go out in my garden and do some weeding that I haven't done and harvest some. I've got carrots that went to seed instead of producing carrots this year because I got fooled by some cold spring weather. But you know, I'm very interested in the environment. I've been very active in that, in many ways through the Finger Lakes, and you know, somehow I've found my way to a region that is just ideal for me. We've got history, we've got natural beauty, we have the fruit belts, we can grow so many things here, and you know, we don't have the pollution and the traffic of big cities, but we're close enough to drive to them. So I love where we are here.
Right. And there's a little bit of funny advertising. Our very natural landscape is the regrowth of a heavily scarred region that was completely thoroughly logged for the most part and also lost much of its topsoil. But it does feel quite natural.
Well, it was also some glaciers changed it rather drastically a few
thousands of years before we changed it again, and now it's changing in yet other ways. But yeah, it's a beautiful place. What brought you here?
Well, I grew up in Rome, New York, so not too far away, and came to the University of Rochester to study economics and political science, and ended up staying here. I got a job at the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester, which is independent, not-for-profit watchdog of government that George Eastman founded a long time ago.
Yeah.
And decided to stay here.
Cool. Well, you brought some music with you. What would you like to start the show with?
Well, I did bring like 15 pieces, so.
So you may have to think for a minute before you land on what you want to open.
Yeah,
right,
but one that I really love that people probably don't know was the theme for my food show on the radio for a long time, Moxie Fruvis, Johnny Saucepan, which Canadian band that is not really well known.
Here we go.
Well, he was just some Johnny Saucepan when he walked into that kitchen, and the chef picked up the odor and put down his Solzhenitsyn. He said, "Make yourself at home, boy, I just pre-warmed all the victuals. You got 20 minutes starting now, create some gourmet victuals. Basil and thy parmesan shrimp, live lobster, hamster, Worcester, Munster, caviar, radicchio, snow peas, scampi, roquefort, minced skirt, booby, fennelite, pork, lox, side fangs, cantaloupe, sheep shanks, buffalo, flatbed, goat, set, soup, gruyere, cheese, and gelare, peas, and a beef, cheese, spas, and a cabbage, and a crawfish claws. Sure, he was just some Johnny Saucepan when he walked into that kitchen, but his genius with the food stuff's got the old chef's taste buds itching. Johnny Saucepan bought the restaurant and the chef came all unglued, but there'll always be a lineup on that strange and wonderful food. Here we go! Basil and Dye, Parmesan, Shrimp, Live Lobster, Hamster, Worcester, Munster, Caviar, Radicchio, Snoopy, Scampi, Roquefort, Meat, Shrimp, Blue Beef, Fennelette, Pork, Lark, Side Flanks, Cantaloupe, Sheepshanks, Provolone, Flatbed, Goatset, Soup, Gruyere, Cheese, Engineer, Please, and a Vichy, Soise, and a Cabbage, and the Crawfish Claws.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Michael Warren Thomas. So Michael, where I like to go early is, what have you had to learn, and what are the experience? What are some experiences you had to have? What did you need to learn in order to know the life that you value and have an idea of what you need to do to live it?
I guess the most important lesson that really my parents and grandparents really taught me was a connection to nature. An awareness of the outdoor environment and our impact on it, and the interplay of all the pieces of our ecosystem, whether it's the cicadas that are singing in the trees here during the summer, or the fireflies that are all over the place right now, or the snowy owls that come and overwinter here in the Rochester area from the Arctic, or the monarch butterflies, which I've done a lot of work raising the butterflies. So, I grew up in the garden growing things and spending time in nature. And I try to encourage people to do that more, maybe even more now during the pandemic.
Right. And what you alluded to the fact that you were gardening as a kid. What were the things that you did with your parents? How did you internalize this connection? How did it become real for you? What did they do? What did you do?
Well, sometimes it was kind of extreme experiences. I was up in Algonquin National Park with my father, which is a pretty remote park compared to the parks around here in Northern Ontario. And we were canoeing and portaging and several day trip, and I was starting the fire maybe the second night, and something blew up in the fire. Don't know what it was, still don't know what it was, and it burned my face. And at that moment, you don't know how bad that burn is.
But
it wasn't, in the end, wasn't terrible. I'm not scarred, but it was very scary, and you realize that you're in a situation which you don't really run into very often, where you can't get help. You can't, we didn't have cell phones up there. We couldn't portage in the dark. And so in a sense, it was a connection to history of what, what our people came before us dealt with, that we really don't have to deal with anymore. And the other thing that really affected me, I guess, was being a pioneer family at the Genesee Country Village and Museum, where we lived for 3 days in an 1802 cabin with our kids, and saw what a special place the museum is. We've always loved it. And again, connected to history and to nature. And those were a couple of experiences that I always look back on and always kind of moderate what I'm doing and how I'm thinking about things.
Right. And I see it go in a couple of different directions. One is it gives you that historical connection, but also when there was less social and physical infrastructure, people had to have a stronger and more developed sense of personal agency to just take on whatever challenge has got thrown up in their faces. And you experienced that in the night up in Algonquin.
In a literal sense, yeah. Thrown up in my face.
Exactly.
It's a realization of vulnerability, which we could use a little bit, I think, during this pandemic. And especially maybe younger people who feel like they're not vulnerable. Like, this is just going to be a cold, a flu, and we don't really run into too many situations and I'll say this as a white person, and we can get into Black Lives Matter and things, but I think it's a vulnerability that perhaps immigrants feel when they come to this country and they don't speak the language, and it's a vulnerability that, you know, a Black person feels when a knee is on their neck, and we don't, or at least, you know, I've been lucky not to feel that vulnerability very often.
No, it's we can go into this more later. As white folks, we don't experience it in quite the same way. When I arrived at Cornell as an undergrad, I had a very nasal sound like this, and I talked funny, and I came from Northwest Missouri, and one of my childhood friends had been gunned down by the police with 100 bullets to take him out. He was an angry young man who was very smart, but he just got crosswise, and one out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20, and this was in 1970, in the late 1970s, mid and late 1970s, because of bad health care, fights with the police, drugs, alcohol, driving, all this stuff. So there's also some white, I'm not a total freak or oddity. There are some white experience that has had that kind of marginalized place. Sure. It hasn't been well documented, and it can't take the place of Black Lives or Black Lives Matters, because it's not the same kind of thing, but there are some very strong similarities. We just haven't had to learn them. I want to go back also to something you said at the very opening. Part of your I've seen two reactions to this pandemic, and one is this kind of irrational lack of vulnerability, and the other one is the irrational fear of contagion, which is really extreme and crippling. It seems, and so what I'm seeing is people haven't learned how to moderate that with a sense of we take risks all the time. It's just a matter of being as savvy as we can and forgive ourselves for our failures and for those who fail around us, because that's all going to happen. But it just seems like we rush to be careless or to be, you know, rigidly careful, assuming we have more control in some ways than we actually do. But
yeah, and then we get in a car, which is, driving that car is one of the more dangerous things that we could do.
And that's on it. I'm wondering, when you are in nature and you're vulnerable and you are also responsible, there's just a quality of immediacy that you have to make the life you live, but not because you choose it, but because you have to figure it out. And it's a compromise all over the place. And we don't do compromise well at this time in history. But if you garden, you know about compromise. I mean, you know your carrots bolted, you know, despite your best intentions.
That's right. It's adaptability. It's also optimism. I think gardeners tend to be optimistic people. You realize some of the things you plant will die or bolt and go to seed, and you fill something in that space, and you keep going. And I think gardening is just an optimistic activity, which we could use a lot these days.
Right. And what you said earlier, you used the term, or maybe you didn't use the term, but what I inferred was you talked about experiencing as a child the bounty of the earth, the bounty of the environment, the bounty of life. And that's what I read into your describing yourself and how you enjoy savoring life, and that's even part of your handle.
Yeah, it is.
How did you come to awareness to frame it as savoring? My word.
I guess it was the best term that I could come up with that covers a lot of territory. There are many ways to savor life. It's not just food and wine and natural beauty. So it's a flexible term in a sense.
Right. But to savor something means you take time with it. You anticipate it. You also realize its absence when it's not possible. When you're engaging in that process of savoring, I guess my question again is, how did you learn to savor things as opposed to cling to them or move through them too quickly? We have a culture that just wants to move through stuff too quickly in many, many ways.
So I think, you know, one way to learn to savor is to have those things taken away from you. And one kind of common thing, when I get a sinus infection, I couldn't taste or smell food. And I really get a sense for what it's like for people who don't care about food. It's, you got to eat it. It's a textural thing. It's not particularly pleasurable. It's just something it's like putting gas in your car. You got to do it. And when I lost the sense of taste and smell, which does happen with COVID, this was sinus infections for several years in a row. And then it comes back, and then you realize, wow, this tastes so good. And it actually happens seasonally here. Well, right now, we just finished or wrapping up strawberry season. Those taste so amazing. And so it's kind of a reminder that we need to savor those things because I love the seasonality. I love the fact, and I eat so much asparagus during asparagus season, I don't even want to see it for the next 9 months. I just don't want to see it.
Yeah.
It's available, it's in the stores, it looks good, but I don't want any. And so the seasons, which you don't really have in Florida and other parts of the world, I love that here. It helps me savor spring. It helps me savor the first flurries of snow in the winter.
Let's cut to music. What should we play at this moment?
It's a tough choice, but let's go with Lion King.
And do you want to say anything about that choice?
Well, it's in celebration of Garth Fagan dance because he choreographed his original Broadway cast. It is by far my favorite version of the music, and Garth Fagan's from Rochester and a world renowned amazing person, and our daughters were able to take part in dance classes, and we got to know some of the dancers, and they are just such lovely people. Even though they're world famous, such down to earth, great people that you really should go out of your way to see Garth Fagan dance perform in the future.
And it also comes down to this, you have a deeply personal relationship with everything from this region. It's just another example of it with your kids. Yeah, it's sweet. Thank you.
Baba more to see
and ever be seen, or to do than can ever be done. There is far too much to take in here, more defined than can ever be found. But the sun rolling high through the sapphire sky keeps great and small on the endless round. It's a
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Michael Warren Thomas. So Michael, how has life surprised you? How have things played out, or your work or your personal life played out in ways that you would not have anticipated or even necessarily chosen?
Lots of ways. I've, in some ways, I've kept the radio shows over, which I'd done for 26 years, as somewhat of a constant, but kind of fell into those. Originally, I was at a place in Rochester called Donuts Delight, and this is when I had a landscape design business. So I've always been somewhat of an entrepreneur, and the person at the counter said, "Oh, you have great voice for radio. Are you on the radio?" And I said, "No," but it got me thinking. I was doing a lot of classes in gardening, and Doc and Katie Abraham had been on the radio. They lived in Naples, and they had been on the radio when they for 52 years.
Wow.
At that point, not that many, but in the end, they were on for 52 years. So I didn't set out to do radio. But I liked the educational part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I started with a gardening show and added food and wine and things after that. But you know, when I was in college or as a high, you know, as a high school student, I wanted to be a forest ranger in Alaska. So the radio part has connected me more deeply to the region and, mm-hmm. than almost any job that I could have had. And you know, I still do it.
Right, right. And how much of a, how much of your life is it? And, you know, half time, a third time, three quarters of your, how much of your time do you spend on your radio shows?
Well, the gardening I'm going to do this afternoon is research for my gardening show. So
yes, that's right.
The food that I'm going to cook tonight is, you know, might appear on Instagram or, you know, talk about the garlic scapes on my online broadcast. So in a sense, most of what I do is connected.
Right. You have a life and not a profession.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's what, so I grew up, we had 2 acres of garden. We put away 1,000 pounds of potatoes in the fall. They would last and have seed potatoes for the next year. We slaughtered our own pigs and cattle and chickens and rabbits and deer and whatever. So I grew up very much in that kind of being attuned with the seasons and you produce your own food. But you kind of, you know, life is also what you talk about. And one of the things that we're doing here is we're visiting in the sense of a late 19th or early 20th century, kind of just talking about what matters. Two guys who don't really know each other, just kind of trying to figure out what the world is about and what we've been about in that world. And you've found a way to give people a window into your universe.
Yeah, that's a lot of what my shows are about, I guess. And also trying to spotlight a lot of the little things, the little places, the little businesses that people don't know about. I've been a huge advocate for local independent businesses for, mm-hmm. for years. They're what give us this sense of community are these sometimes eclectic, sometimes strange, sometimes you know, just fascinating people and businesses that are, you know, you go to a bunch of them rather than going to one big box store and getting everything.
Right. And it becomes an adventure.
It is. It is. And it's also a connection with community because right. You get to know those farmers or those store owners or the staff at the local coffee shop.
Right. And you're using the way you've just used community. It's something that we go out and we discover and we engage by our own actions and by what other people have done in our environment around us for us to partake of. If you organize a community, you destroy it. You end up with an organization. But if you have all of these people who are available for relating and willing, then you can kind of engage. And people engage, like you say, some of them are really quirky. Some of them are kind of weird. Some of them are pretty straight-laced. There are all sorts of types of people out there. And we get to know. And you're providing a service of letting us know who they are, which is, it's journalism, but it's also just good communication. And it's not gossip. One of the things that in this culture that we haven't gotten, you know, all these conversations that are personal in nature are not private, but they're also not manipulative. So much of the main news is manipulative.
Well, yes and no. I had a listener contact me recently who felt that the way I talked about the environment was, in her terms, virtue signaling, which is not a term that I'd run into before. And they also felt that about the way I talked about wearing masks, that I've been pleading for people to wear masks. We're not doing it here because we're on Zoom, but for our business, you know, science has shown that masks work and we need to keep our businesses alive. We need to keep them reopening and I guess the only virtue part of wearing a mask is it shows respect for other people, which is important, but
right.
It's science that really, you know.
Well, so, it's science established the effectiveness but what we have, in my less than humble opinion, We have lived in a culture of profound disrespect for most of the last 60 years, and it's just gotten worse. And it began
with disrespect of people, or disrespect to the environment,
disrespect of people, but it also translates into the environment. And I mean, we don't believe we have to take other people as seriously as we take ourselves. We don't really believe in equality. And by that, and that's how we can be so disrespectful from the left to the right or whatever. We can be profoundly dismissive of what people care about. And as a consequence, when science shows us that something works, people could give a shit because they don't care. And in fact, to care or to virtue signal, as that person accused you of, might actually, you know, they might see it as a political statement or as a self-aggrandizing statement rather than just a human thing to do with other equal human beings. And that's really sad. That's where I come down. I think we blew it a long time ago, so that it, in some sense, it, for some people, it doesn't matter what the science says. And you know, whether it's 6 feet or 3 feet or a mask all the time or a mask, you know, when you're less than 6 feet, all, you know, the science will always be a little ambiguous on the finer details, but on the main thrust is pretty clear.
And science does change, you know, yeah, as they learn more.
And we change as our bodies age and fail, or we gain skills or lose them. We're all moving targets. We don't hold each other in that kind of respect, you know, but you really treat each person with a profound amount of human respect.
So why do you think about 60 years ago as the time of change?
I think when we made social change a matter of coercive policy, even for good ends, we began to alienate people from their government. And the right has been alienated at times, the left has been alienated at times, and right now not a lot of people really trust it, though we trust the idea of it, which I think is your comment about gardening and optimism. I think we wish it would work out. But I don't think we have a good track record of being able to live with profound moral differences and create space for those. Black lives in some sense only matter if they look like white professional lives, only in black. You know, I mean, they're class issues, and we have not learned how to respect cultural differences or religious differences or moral differences, and to be a society that's not as monolithic as the European nations, we're going to have the American path is one of respect or it's failure. That's my less than humble opinion. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to launch off on a sermon here, but that's another matter.
I was the one that asked you, so I asked you the question. So, yeah. I have to, you know, it seems like the sides are so polarized that respect is not possible, and we've got to find a way to reestablish that somehow.
Yeah,
I don't have those answers,
and neither do I. But I one of the first lessons I learned in life was that I loved people who hated each other.
They're interesting,
and therein lies a start.
How about people just disagree with each other?
Well, the thing is that if they disagree, they can generally help each other out, even when they don't care about the ends that they want. You know, you'll help a neighbor do something you don't think is a smart idea, but they're going to do it whether you help them or not. You know, I mean, that's what a person who is treating other people as their equals will do. You don't have to want their life, but you want to see them have a good shot at it, or else they'll become bitter and antagonistic and otherwise difficult to live with.
Which in your interest, yes.
Right, so it's in everybody's interest to be helpful wherever we can, but we do have to take time and, as you say, savor. We need to savor one another as much as we savor the things we consume.
Yeah, so do we savor differences or do we savor likeness? And that's what
savor each in its season, each by turn.
But that's what, like, social media allows us to savor within a bubble, and that means that you don't maybe learn as much about the differences. You don't, I don't have too many friends who are, I don't really have any that are debating me about wearing a mask, because I'm in a bubble of people who see it that way, the way I do. But there are millions of people who don't. I just don't have contact with those other than listening.
And here in Ithaca, the people that I know who resist wearing a mask won't debate it, but I know them. But they know that they have been cowed by a dominant public perception, which pretty much silences their speaking, unless we create a really, really good environment where people can feel like they can have an opinion which they feel they can defend reasonably, but also that they can live. So it's, you know, they're also wearing masks because they are good people. They will abide by a mandate, even if they don't necessarily agree with all of the interpretations.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I'm optimistic as a gardener, less so politically.
Yeah. And I don't have answers either. I just have some experiences that are kind of outside the norm. Let's cut to music. What should we play now?
There's a lot of cello in my family,
cello and violin, as I understand.
Yeah, cello and viola. Viola. Our family. So maybe the two cellos, Thunderstruck, which is a fun video to watch beyond just listening to it.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Michael Warren Thomas. So I'm gonna go off script a little bit here. You've used the word optimistic, and sometimes I would prefer to use the word hopeful, but I know that in certain circles it's taken on a pejorative meaning. Optimism in my, where I'm from, is a bet on the future, and hope is a stance of openness to the future. And one is a calculation and the other one is a way of being engaged. And I think you're describing being engaged. It doesn't matter whether we call it optimism or hope, but there are people out there who hope is poison for certain people who've been influenced by the teachings of Buddhism. Hope makes you live in a future that isn't real, as opposed to being open to whatever comes. We get into these little things. What is it that you're not optimistic about politics, but what is it that keeps you engaged in getting up and doing and living the life that you've been able to create for yourself? You know, where do you find yourself being fed these days, and where do you find yourself looking to be fed that's not working?
I'm not sure about the looking to be fed that's not working, but
I took it to be the politics or something that you would like to see happen, but it's not.
We found the house that we live in and have lived in for 26 years because it was a HUD house and inexpensive, and we liked the neighbors, a couple of them that we met. And we didn't choose it because of the overall neighborhood, but in the end, we were and are so grateful that we ended up here. It's the 19th ward in Rochester, which has, I think, the oldest community association in the country. It's also one of the most diverse neighborhoods, at least in the region, if not the state. And that's, every day I can see, we have a pride flag on our front porch. A bunch of neighbors have them. There's Black Lives Matter flags that we're going to be putting up. And the opportunity to live diversity day to day is what really makes getting up in the morning and being in this community so fascinating and sometimes challenging. We fell into this community, if we had looked around Rochester and, where do we want to live now, we would have chosen this community. And it's being here that really gives me the optimism in people, even if I don't have optimism in politics, I guess.
Right. And it wasn't your arrival there wasn't exactly a rational decision, although you could rationalize it now.
It was rational in terms of the best house for the price.
But that isn't the other things you were talking about, the two people that you met. And this is one of the things that, again, you didn't throw caution to the wind. It made financial sense, but you also didn't expect to be able to predict exactly the life you would want to live.
You kind of
grew into it. And that's just a wonderful thing. And it means that you're open and available for what happens.
Yeah.
To an extent.
I wonder how it would have been different if we had found an inexpensive home in a suburb. Or in the rural area. Would we have found our place and grown into it there like we've grown into it here? It's that's kind of a fun question to think about.
Right, and in many ways it's unanswerable, but it's also an exercise in maintaining yourself a nimble, to hold yourself lightly.
Hopefully.
No. I mean, we get tied up in knots about stuff, for good or for ill. What has been the hardest part of living in your neighborhood?
I guess it's seen poverty up close. It's seen, in some cases, mental illness or you know, some of the challenges of society. Having someone, it just takes one person to do this, rip down the pride flags on the street at night. You know, just one person, but it affects the community. So I think one of the advantages of where we live in the city is we have all these big front porches, like, you know, and people don't tend to park their cars in garages. They park them on the driveway, and we're out in the street more. And, you know, I grew up in the suburbs, kind of in Rome, New York, and, you know, the garage door would go up, person would drive in, the garage door would go down, and you would not see anyone. And this is during the summer, unless maybe they were mowing their lawn, or, you know, often it's a mowing service that comes, they don't even have to do that. And it's the front porches and the proximity that encourage engagement, whereas the separation and not to generalize about suburbs, but, you know, that's the way it is. You have less contact often because you can kind of self-isolate in your house and your property.
Right, and there are some efforts to try to research whether the suburbs are more or less safe for COVID-19 at times, or compared to other kinds of dwelling places, urban or rural.
Sure.
One of the things that most people didn't realize, you know, the rural poor and the urban poor live in almost identical densities within their homes. It's just that their homes are more spread apart.
Yeah.
In terms of the doubling up on rooms and, you know, stuffing more people into a smaller space just because it's cheaper. It's cheaper in a rural area or in an urban area. And those have real effects on mental health and decision-making capacity that sometimes are not real good.
But there's a walkability, and that's, you know, we talk about, you know, sure, density, sure, and sprawl and all of those issues, but being able to walk places, the suburbs are trying to create that in some developments. But that's also what I enjoy about living in the city. And that's what a lot of people are moving back to the city for, condos and lofts and, you know, buildings are being renovated, and they can walk places and not, live 20 minutes away from the theater and things.
That, right. And that I think has held as long as it's for children or after children, but that middle group is still tending to move out to the suburbs where they can deal with different schools and have a different set of issues for raising children. It's an interesting time we live in.
And our neighborhood, 20 years ago, the neighborhood elementary school was, I don't know, maybe 30-40% white. Today it's 1%. It's 99% African American, and we see it all the time in our neighborhood. People, young people, move in, have children, and then move to the suburbs because of the schools. And the schools and Monroe County in general has resisted the idea of incorporating city, urban, and suburban schools together more. But we are setting up generations of poverty and all health and all kinds of other challenges by ignoring the effects of poverty in city schools.
And the consequences of different educational attainment or aspirations.
Right. Right. And so, you know, we read about white flight. We've watched it, you know, neighbor down the street moved a couple of years ago. Their children got to be 2-3 years old and, you know, they moved to Brighton or Pittsburgh.
Right.
So it's kind of, you know, it's like we haven't learned anything in all these years about what we should be doing differently.
Ithaca is a fairly gentrified place. We have about a quarter of our workforce commutes into the county from outside. Only New York City has a higher commutation rate in New York State than Ithaca, than Tompkins County. And so we've seen a lot of I've got some black families coming back into my neighborhood in Fall Creek, but many of them, almost all of them, moved out in the late 90s and early 2000s. Now some, you know, with more professional skills and more resources are moving back in. It's a wild time. Michael, what should we play next musically?
Got to play Sissel, Sirkabo Solvay's song. It's by Edvard Grieg, and people know her, probably not her name, from Titanic.
Right.
They may recognize her voice. And I spent a year in Norway as an exchange student, and I am part Norwegian, so it has a bunch of different connections for me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made a Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Michael Warren Thomas. So, Michael, the way I like to close the show is with just some reflections that you have on how you take care of yourself throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, and emotionally, physically, intellectually, and how you know you need to do something to take care of yourself. Because part of this show is helping people to just show up more the way they want to show up in life.
Well, it would come as no surprise to people that have heard this whole interview that spending time in nature is what, you know, if I'm feeling upset, if I'm feeling frustrated, if, you know, just a lot of negative things seem to be happening, I'll spend time in my yard, I'll spend time in the woods. And I don't mean weeks, I mean, you know, an hour.
Right, minutes and hours.
Yeah. So that's, I think, one of the key ways that I take care of myself and also just connecting with family and friends. And I think also going out to the farmers markets and getting black raspberries and tomatoes and sweet corn right now. I mean, those things just are, you know, comfort food in a sense. And it's back to that seasonality idea of you know, savoring where we are right now. And it's, I guess, mindfulness in a sense too, that it's grounding yourself in where we are in time and in space.
When you notice that you need to take better care of yourself, what do you notice? When you notice that you need to, I don't know, go out in the woods, go out in your garden, connect with family, what do you notice in yourself that begins to say, I need to take care of myself?
I begin to see things in more negative ways. So it's sort of like, you know, generally I'm an optimist and I see the glasses half full. If I'm looking at or just having conversations with people and I'm feeling like, you know, the glass is half empty for as my reaction, then I kind of know that I've got to take a break from it, I guess, and rejuvenate my soul a little bit.
It also sounds like when you do your time in nature or your gardening, you're probably almost doing enough physical activity that counts as real exercise.
Yeah, that's often the case. Yeah. And that's helpful too.
And so that's what I was wondering. How do you take care of yourself in terms of the physical piece and just being?
You know, my wife would go out and run. That would be her way. I might take a bicycle ride, but I think the physical nature of pruning, of transplanting, of harvesting is more of the way that I go about it. So less directly physically, but it's a factor of it.
Right. And so they say that if you clean your own house or your own office, if you take care of your own place over the course of the week, you will get the exercise you need. If you do those things fairly vigorously, and it just gets built into your way of life. So what impresses me is that you really, I'm asking you to think about things that are almost nonsensical because they're part of your way of life.
Yeah, kind of. You know, after I do a little gardening today, I'm going to go look for eggs that monarchs laid on the milkweed in my yard and probably bring some of those inside because the spiders will eat them if I don't. And,
right.
You know, the last 3 years, I've raised about 150 monarchs from my little city property. And, you know, that is, you know, I guess a small contribution to to nature and so improving the world. There's a lot of ways I can't improve the world, but I can maybe here in my neighborhood and with neighbors and with family and friends.
And you see the nature in your neighborhood, which a lot of people simply overlook since you live in what would have been an old city neighborhood.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, you can have a window box in an apartment, and the bees and perhaps the butterflies will come visit, and nature is the ants in the sidewalk. I mean, it's some of it's annoying, but a lot of it's fascinating.
And it's pervasive if we just take the time to look.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, the mindfulness part of it is trying to think about what you're looking at rather than the email that someone sent you that you're upset about.
Right.
And you can get back to that email, but for now, I'm just going to look for monarch eggs.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, and it's running a little late, but I want to, when did you realize in your life that choice between whether you spend more time with the aggravation or spend time getting centered so you can address it, when did you learn that taking care of your emotional life was your responsibility and not that you really had to do that?
I have no idea.
It just happened. Yeah.
I'm still learning it, I think.
I know everybody is, but some people kind of the light bulb goes off when they're 60 or when they're 30. I've talked to some people who, when parents separated and it was messy, they learned at 5 that they couldn't count on the adults in their lives, so they had to kind of learn how to emotionally take care of themselves. But people pick it up in different ways, and you seem to just have ambled into it.
I think that's right. It wasn't a switch going off.
Yeah, yeah.
We're on.
Michael, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Eric, thank you. I've done interviews for 26 years. I really like it when someone else is asking the questions, and especially thoughtful, interesting, and just thought-provoking questions.
And we can probe each other, which was what we did, and I enjoyed that a lot too. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
What should we close the show with musically?
How about the piano guys doing Coldplay Paradise? And people should watch this video. It's pretty cool.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Eric. I shot another night of sun. I got the yeah, yeah. I got the yeah, Meno we'll be right back.
Singapore, God, I promise it.